Juneteenth is officially June 19th, and the day marks a significant day in American history. There have been various accounts of the meaning of the day and the events that took place after the Civil War. In my interview with activist and historian Kwame Abdul-Bey, we find out the real story behind Juneteenth. This is All the Way Authentic. I'm your host, Kevin P. Henry.
I love June for a number of reasons, but Juneteenth is one of them because, I mean, I have no problem with the 4th of July or taking the day off and going to a barbecue, but my ancestors were not free in 1776. So as a Black person, I really don't relate to it on that level. But yet when Juneteenth comes up every year, there's a certain amount of maybe, I don't know, pushback, controversy about, well, you know, why are we celebrating this? And we have the 4th of July and there's too many of these, you know, racial holidays and we, you know, we should just all be Americans. So I wanted to get, because you did such a great job last time, just telling the story about what Juneteenth is. And so walk me through that same story about, you know, because I think originally you had asked me, well, what do you know about it? I said, well, what I heard was that, you know, it was the day where all the slaves found out, you know, the ones specifically in Texas, that they were free. And you really walked me through it and said, well, okay, there's a lot more to this story. So so please walk me through that again.
Oh, my gosh. Juneteenth. First and foremost, just to let you know, there is no one specific Juneteenth. Juneteenth is based on the biblical Jubilee celebration. And there's actually different Juneteenth celebrations that start in Washington, D.C. and go all the way to Texas. So for each state, they have a different Juneteenth. And it was the Jubilee, or the when the Americans who were enslaved finally realized their freedom on paper. So when General Gordon Granger arrived with his troops, and it's very important that I say with his troops, because the way the story is told is that he arrived there all by himself and he said, y'all's free. That didn't happen like that. So he arrived in Galveston, Texas with his troops. There he ordered the final enforcement of the Emancipation Proclamation. Now, that is the short story of what we're all told. But as you stated, it's a much bigger picture. First and foremost, the Emancipation Proclamation that President Abraham Lincoln authored, that we're told, is not the first Emancipation Proclamation. There were actually two other Emancipation Proclamations that occurred before the one that Abraham Lincoln signed. The first one was issued about, I think, 3 years earlier by a general here in Arkansas. And what that general did when he entered Arkansas, he literally emancipated all of the enslaved Arkansans throughout Arkansas. And that was the first Emancipation Proclamation by, I believe, 3 years. And that particular general ended up being fired because of what he did. And about a year or so later, another general here did a similar event. So the original Emancipation Proclamation actually happened in Arkansas and not in Texas. So when the Emancipation Proclamation was enacted, it was written in a way where it only really dealt with the states that were not really under Union control. They were under Confederate control. So any slave, any quote unquote slave states that were in the Union, the enslaved Americans within those states were not freed. It was only the states that were in rebellion. And the Emancipation Proclamation was not something that just automatically happened. It had to happen by force. So the Union troops had to go state by state by state by state to literally enact the Emancipation Proclamation. Now, the reason we're told the story about Texas, because Texas was the last state that the Union troops entered to enact the Emancipation Proclamation. A lot of people don't understand why that happened. Well, what happened was when the Confederate states finally surrendered, and they surrendered Virginia, the Confederacy was made up of several different states that had several different opinions, and those opinions kind of that union kind of fell apart once the Confederacy surrendered in Appalachia. So several states refused to surrender, and there were also several enslavers. Slavery was a big economic business. So those people who were making a lot of money and who made a lot of money in the practice of slavery, they wanted to keep their wealth. So when the surrender happened in Virginia, there's a lot of slaveholders that began to escape, and they went west. So starting in Virginia, you have people escaping to Alabama. You have people escaping to Mississippi. You have people escaping to Arkansas. And as the Union troops chased them west, they left Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, Louisiana, and went to Texas. And several of them actually ended up in Mexico, in Central America, and still today there is a state in Brazil that where a lot of descendants of the Confederacy actually still live today. So what happened on this particular day that we know as Juneteenth was there was a group of soldiers that was doing the chasing, that was chasing these slaveholders and these Confederates that refused to give up. We don't hear much about those troops that were chasing them. Those troops were the United States colored troops. The United States colored troops were enslaved Americans who gained their freedom either by escaping or gained their freedom by revolting, or gained their freedom through the emancipation, the enactment of the Emancipation Proclamation. So they would join the Union troops, and they led the way chasing these ex-Confederates west. So in the period that we now know as Juneteenth, when General Granger landed in Galveston, he landed there with nothing but the United States colored troops. So when you talk about who freed the slaves in Texas, it was not some white man that walked in there and said, "You're free." No, these are United States colored troops that are chasing these ex-Confederates and chased them down into Mexico, the ones that got away. And interestingly enough, those United States colored troops, once the Civil War was over, they continued journeying west and they became known as the Buffalo Soldiers.
I appreciate that. I really appreciate you going into the detail about that. And the other thing I want to ask you too is that I think some people are under the idea that, well, you know, once the enslaved people were no longer slaves, everything got remarkably better for Black people. And that, you know, everything was equal, everything was fine, and they know nothing about what happened after what you're talking about. And they're under that impression that things got so much better once that, quote, slavery was over. So maybe talk a little bit about what happened after that and what that was like for Black people.
Well, as I'm exploding some of the myths that surround Juneteenth, another myth that I want to explode is that the enslaved Americans in Texas did not know about the Emancipation Proclamation. That is incorrect. As I stated, they were these wealthy slaveholders were escaping from Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and moving west. And they were taking their enslaved Americans with them by force. So the idea that these enslaved Americans did not know about the Emancipation Proclamation is mostly false. And it's mostly false because even at that time, during the Civil War, you know, the telegraph lines that connected Washington, D.C. with Houston, Texas, those telegraph lines were already in play and they were being used by not only governments, but they were also being used by the press, by the media. So there are pockets of people who did not know that the Emancipation Proclamation was in effect. Matter of fact, but that wasn't the larger story. An overwhelming majority of them knew what was going on. There was just a chase that was happening that we don't really hear about in the history books. Now, there were some that did not know. For instance, here in Arkansas, there was a case with a gentleman who was actually a minister who, after the Civil War, a couple of years after the Civil War, he had a plantation where he was still holding about a dozen slaves captive and would not release them. And he ended up being charged and convicted of violating the Emancipation Proclamation. And that was the first ever federal conviction of someone who was charged with violating the Emancipation Proclamation. So the reality was that this, you know, once the Emancipation Proclamation was signed, the sun did not, you know, come up and, you know, birds were tweeping and then everybody was singing like in, you know, they were like in Gone with the Wind or something like that. What happened was terror. The ex-Confederates, they reorganized and became the Ku Klux Klan. And the Ku Klux Klan decided that they were going to continue to fight the Civil War through violence and terror and lynchings and expulsions and literally burning cities down. Now, the most consequential period of American history that is not even taught in schools, K through 12, is the period of Reconstruction. The period of Reconstruction is a defining moment because it shows two reactions to the end of the Civil War. As far as the formerly enslaved Americans, it shows their prosperity. It shows their solidarity. It shows their willingness to begin where they were and make their lives better for themselves, for their families, for their communities, for their governments, because we saw a large number of formerly enslaved Americans who were elected as congresspersons, who were congressmen at that time. I say congresspersons because I like to think that I'm including everyone, but at that time it was only men that were allowed. So congressmen, there were senators, there were governors, lieutenant governors, there were state legislators, there were mayors, all of these different levels of government were open to the formerly enslaved Americans. So for us, Reconstruction era was an era of us coming up out of the big hole that we have been put in and making the quote unquote American dream a reality just by rubbing our two pennies together. On the other side, the reaction was, as you stated, it was a reaction where everything wasn't so hunky-dory. Seeing these formerly enslaved Americans rebound from the horrors of enslavement really infuriated the poor white Americans who were able to see this transition, because the reality was, as race as we know it today is a social construct, and it was created by the wealthy class to keep the poor whites and the blacks in check and keep them fighting each other so that they won't realize what's actually happening. So we see that manifesting after the Civil War. So you have the poor communities who are seeing these formerly enslaved black communities prosper and make something out of nothing, and they form these KKK organizations, because the Ku Klux Klan is not the only organization. There was about six or seven different Klan-like organizations that you know, really terrorized the black community, and we started the era of lynchings. And here in Arkansas, Arkansas has the third or fourth highest number of lynchings that occurred throughout the United States. And when I say that, I say documented lynchings, because for every documented lynching, there is historians believe that there were at least two or three undocumented lynching. So here in Arkansas, there were a total of what we now know 503 documented lynchings. So it is believed that there were at least 1,500 total lynchings.
Well, you know, one thing I just wanted to interject is that even today, sometimes people will, they're under the impression that, okay, well, if you desegregate the schools or you change these laws, it's all good, you know, that people should stop talking about racism because, hey, you know, it's they got rid of this law. Or they enacted some type of law that protects minorities or something like that. But that doesn't change the hearts of people, you know. So just because you enact a law doesn't mean that the racism and the hate isn't still there. So I'm glad that you're explaining that just because the enslaved people were now free, that, like you say, there was a new form of terrorism that that took its place.
Yes. You know, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. talked about the fallacy of legislating love. You can't legislate love. You have to teach it, and you have to teach it and demonstrate it and practice it and participate in it. And it's something that happens at a very young age. When you look at a lot of the pictures of these different lynchings, you see children out participating in these savage forms of terrorism. So turning things like schools into quote unquote integrated communities just by an act of law, a stroke of a pen, does not change the underlying social dynamics, the underlying mentalities, the underlying psychosis that created the situation in the first place. So there's a lot of work that has to be done. There's a lot of relearning that has to be done. And if that is not done in conjunction with these different laws, then all you're doing is putting a new coat of paint on a house that burned down. And what you have to do is you have to tear that house down and you have to rebuild it.
Great way to put that. And I wanted to take that as a transition into what's going on today, because, you know, I personally get so frustrated sometimes with people saying that, well, you know, you keep talking about this and talking about racism just, you know, fuels more racism. You know, that was the past. And, you know, why do we have to keep bringing up these things? Because it's so divisive. But yet I could just turn on the news every single day and at some point hear about a hate crime or hear about some discrimination or hear about somebody being shot merely because of the color of their skin. So it's still with us. The infection is still with us. But what would you say to those people that just say, hey, you know, Kwame, you know, why do you keep bringing this up? You know, it's just so, it just upsets people and it's divisive. We need to all come together as Americans.
Well, here's the thing. White Christian nationalism is what caused the Civil War. White Christian nationalism is what caused the abrupt ending of the Reconstruction era. White Christian nationalism is what caused the segregation of the Southern states. And a lot of people don't want to admit, but there were Northern states that were segregated as well. We had overt segregation and covert segregation. White Christian nationalism is woven into the fabric of this country. And until we address white Christian nationalism, we're never going to solve the problem of this social construct that we know as race. And again, I have to say that race was created. What we know today in the United States as race doesn't exist anywhere in the world the way that it exists here. Now, I have to admit that race is a caste system. We don't call it a caste system, but it is a caste system. But all caste systems, no matter where in the world you encounter them, they're about control. And what it is you have to control the people so that you can control the resources. And when we confront that reality, when we confront the reality of white Christian nationalism, when we confront the reality that our system of race here in the United States was created specifically to make sure that the wealthy Americans stayed in control, and that the less wealthy Americans or the poor Americans spent most of their time arguing and fighting so that they did not have time to rebel against the wealthy elite. When we start having those discussions, I do believe that it will be a more, you know, when you tilling the ground and getting it ready to plant new seeds, that's the tilling of the ground for a new America, is when we start like having these discussions like we talked about earlier with coming to the table. You have to confront reality. You do not stop becoming an alcoholic overnight just because you said, hey, I am no longer alcoholic. That is something that you have to work on for the rest of your life. You have to work on it, and you cannot work on it by yourself. You have to work on it with others, others who are in union with you, all admitting, hey, I am an alcoholic. And you go through those 12-step programs. Well, white Christian nationalism and racism, they're a form of alcoholism. They're a form of drug abuse. They're a drug. And those people who are alcoholics when it comes to white Christian nationalism, when it comes to racism, when it comes to terrorism, they have to go through a 12-step program. And until they go through that 12-step program and come and sit down in therapy and sit down and admit, I am a racist, I am a white Christian nationalist, then nothing's ever going to change. It's going to change on the surface where, you know, we're putting lipstick on a pig, but it is still a pig.
Yeah, I think that was very well said. And I would just add that it's not always, you don't always have to be white to perpetuate the same type of mentality, I think. And included in that mentality, as I said, is this idea that we shouldn't be talking about these things. It reminds me, you know, you talked about 12-step programs. I've often said that it's a form of therapy. You know, when I do trainings or when I do talks or presentations, I always warn people, you know, one 45-minute or hour-long DEI training is not going to offset decades of programming or brainwashing or indoctrination. I don't know anyone that goes into one therapy session and says, you know, hey, I'm no longer an alcoholic. I no longer beat my spouse. You know, it's a lifelong commitment, and you have to be willing to face your demons, put it out on the table, put it in the spotlight, and then talk about it. And it's not always neat, warm, and fuzzy either. It can get messy. I've been in training sessions where people are crying and arguing and yelling at each other because all of this stuff, like I said, like pus is in their system, and now it's coming out. But until it comes out, you know, you're just like you said, it's like putting paint on a burned down house. Anything you'd like to add that I haven't asked, or just that you want people to know that to think about?
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you said that the racism, you don't have to be white to be a racist. And that reality exposes that racism is about power. It's about resources. And when you put it on that level about power and resources and who has the power and who has the resources, racism and white Christian nationalism is a concept where, hey, we're going to put all of the power and the resources under the control of this small segment of the population and be damned with the rest of the population. You don't have to be a white person to agree with, to participate in that. You go to other countries on this planet, and you see racism being acted out and everybody's white. Or you go to the continent of Africa, you see racism being acted out and everybody's melanated. So you don't have to be white to be a racist. We might want to find a new word. It's about control. It's about dominance. It's about power. And it's about resources. And once we understand that, then we can stop being, I guess you call it misgoverned, are governed by this false reality that there's this thing called race that dominates our existence. And we can just stop talking about quote unquote racism, and then that power struggle and that dominance and access to resources will stop. No, that fight continues because there's always going to be a small group of people who wants to have dominance and control over everybody else.
Yeah, very well said. We have a lot of work to do. And it's, again, like you said, and I agree that it's a lifelong commitment.
Yes.
I want to thank my guest, Kwame Abdul-Bey, for giving us the real story behind Juneteenth. This is All the Way Authentic. I'm your host, Kevin P. Henry.